welcome to the Canine Conservationists Podcast, where we're positively obsessed with conservation detection dogs. Join us every week to discuss detection training, canine welfare, conservation biology, and everything in between. I'm Kayla Fratt, one of the co-founders of Canine Conservationists, where we train dogs to detect data for land managers, researchers, agencies, and NGOs. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to my dear friend Tony Preschholt from Utah State about the data that dogs can't detect. Tony has spent 9 seasons studying the social dynamics of the bighorn sheep on the Confederated Salish Kootenai Tribal Bison Range north of Missoula, Montana. She recently defended her master's program studies on that topic. And as I said, Tony's been a dear friend of mine for several years now and is actually traveling with me in Latin America. In fact, she's going to be working as my field tech for our upcoming Guatemala project. She and I have spent many hours chatting about how our research the differences in our research and the sorts of data that our different methodologies can detect. So welcome to the podcast, Tony.
Hi, happy to be here.
And just so you all know, at home, Tony and I are recording outdoors at a hostel in El Salvador. There are some quite noisy trucks going by on the highway with some very loud compression brakes occasionally. I really hope our mic isn't picking up too much of it. But if it is, I do apologize. It's the best we can do with the tools we have right now. It was either trucks or the roaring ocean. So with that, we'll get on to the rest of the episode. So I'm really excited to get to this interview, but before we dive into it, we're going to talk about our science highlight, which is titled, Can Volunteers Train Their Pet Dogs to Detect a Novel Odor in a Controlled Environment in Under 12 Weeks? This was published in the Journal of Veterinary Behavior by Nick Rutter and the rest of the team over there, and was published in 2021. So this science highlight was prepared by our volunteer Heidi Benson, and is titled, Can Volunteers Train Their Pet Dogs to Detect a Novel Odor in a Controlled Environment in Under 12 Weeks? It was published in the Journal of Veterinary Behavior in 2021 by Nick Rutter, as well as the rest of his co-authors. So, while conservation detection dogs can be an effective and non-invasive method for monitoring in wildlife, the cost of training and maintaining a detection dog and handler team can be cost prohibitive, especially given the seasonal nature of the work. Because environmental groups often utilize volunteer efforts, the authors were wondering if it would be feasible to create a model where volunteers train their personal dogs to work as conservation detection dogs. Quote, the aim in this study was to commence this process by determining whether a 12-week program is sufficient to teach novice volunteers and their pet dogs with varying levels of training experience to detect novel odors indoors under controlled conditions. The second goal of the study was to determine if the dog's performance in detecting odor was retained after several months of not training. The study took place in Victoria, Australia. There were 17 volunteer dog handler teams with varying levels of experience that all completed a 12-week scent training program developed and led by 2 professional conservation detection dog handlers, in which the dogs were trained to detect myrrh essential oils. The 12-week program consisted of 9 weekly 2-hour training classes and 3 2-day workshops. There were 4 stages: 1, odor introduction; 2, scent board introduction; 3, shaping and alert behavior; and 4, searching independently on the scent board. Participants were also provided with supplies for at-home training and asked to train for 10 minutes once every 2 to 3 days and record training notes in a logbook. Demographics and information regarding past training and volunteer experience of dog handler teams was gathered via an online self-report questionnaire. Dogs in the study were between 1 and 9 years old and represented a variety of breeds, including Labrador, Mini Poodle, Border Collie, Staffordshire Terrier, and Samoyed, among others. Assessments of training progression were done at 8 and 12 weeks. Quote, at week 12, teams correctly located the target in 96.39% of standard board searches, 94.12% of standard room searches, and 100% of obstacle room searches. Teams also correctly identified 85.29% of targets presented among novel distractor odors in distraction board searches. Finally, 64.71% of blank board and 70.59% of blank room searches were scored as correct with no false alerts made. A post-training assessment was conducted at 26 weeks after 14 weeks of not training. Only 11 of the 17 teams completed the post-training assessment due to major life changes and availability. No significant differences were found between results gathered during 12-week assessment and the 26-week post-training assessment, suggesting that search performance can be maintained in the absence of maintenance training. The authors conclude that a volunteer model for conservation detection dogs may be both possible and economical. Volunteer teams may be particularly helpful for projects that need many dogs for a short period of time. They also note that it is imperative for teams to be evaluated in the field prior to deployment. Some aspects of the study relied on self-reported data, which is subjective and can introduce bias, although the important part about the dog performance does not sound like it was self-reported in any way. It was a small sample size, so correlational analyses were likely underpowered, but this is actually a better sample size than we generally see in the conservation dog world, so I'm not going to pick on them too hard for that. And the study did not test whether volunteer dogs will be successful in a real-world conservation detection dog role, only whether volunteers can teach their dog to detect a novel odor in a controlled indoor environment. There's another paper that we're going to summarize in an upcoming episode titled Diving in Nose First, the Influence of Unfamiliar Search Scale and Environmental Context on the Search Performance of Volunteer Conservation Detection Dog Handler Teams. So this study that we highlighted today is a good precursor to that, but obviously there's quite a bit more research to be done to see how volunteers can progress from a scent board indoors to actually taking them outside and into the field. But this study is definitely helpful as kind of a baseline confirmation that dogs can do this. So, whew. All right, Tony, why don't we start out by talking a little bit about your research? Tell us what you've been up to for the last 9 seasons.
Yeah, so I had the great fortune to get involved with this incredible long-term study that was started by Dr. Jack Hogg in 1979. And I came on the project just as a technician in 2018 in the fall. And it's focused on the social dynamics of bighorn sheep. So that involvement allowed me to have the opportunity to do my master's with some of these data that have been collected in the process of the long-term study. And what's really cool about this study is that it is completely observational. So all of the sheep involved in this study, they're all wild sheep living on the bison range in Montana. But none of them are collared and none of them have ear tags. And Dr. Hogg has established identifying characteristics for every single one of the sheep in this herd for 40 plus years. So we have this incredible wealth of information about this herd and about these individual sheep that allow us to ask questions that frankly can't really be asked anywhere else, or can't be answered anywhere else at least. So specifically for my thesis, I was really focused on the ewes, which are very social animals, but a lot less has been done to try to figure out what exactly motivates them to form the groups that they form in these social environments. So really what I do is I go out there and I look for sheep, and often I find them. Not always. They are wild sheep and they aren't wearing collars, as I mentioned. But so basically the main meat and potatoes kind of this study is just a general census of going out, and during the 2 main seasons that we were focused on, including the rut season, the breeding season in the fall, and the lamb rearing season in like May to June, and into July often. And we want to go out there and find every single sheep if possible, or as many as we can find, and essentially just take a census of who was in what group, when and where. So we have location information and we have group composition information for all of these animals. And for each animal, we often know the down to the day of when it was born. We know who their parents are and who their grandparents are, and a lot of that has been verified by a really intensive pedigree done of the entire population through 2013. And Jack was basically right all of the time. So it's really an incredible data set. And I've been really lucky to be able to use some of that for my thesis, which was focused on trying to understand what is motivating the sheep to choose groups over other groups, whether that's there's a stronger pull for choosing groups that have their mother in them, or is it just group size, or is it siblings or age groups, that sort of thing.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, and it's so cool. I mean, so this study has been around since 1979. It's been on progress. So it's 40 plus years old now. So, I think when I first met you and you were telling me about this, I was like, oh my God, this is like the Jane Goodall project of bighorn sheep. And as I think is obvious from the title of this episode, this is just the sort of data that you couldn't get with dogs, because you're talking about, you know, if the scats were deposited, if you had a dog trained to find scats and the scats were deposited 20 minutes apart, that wouldn't actually tell you as much about who was hanging out with whom as potentially who was following whom or who just kind of passed through because there was some really tasty grass. They mostly grass? Yeah. Forbs?
Yeah, grass and forbs.
Grass and forbs. I was like, they're not like lichen eaters, right? basic questions Kayla does not know about Tony's project. It's just so interesting to think about just this micro level of data that just would not be possible with dogs. So you said you get out there, I assume very early in the morning, you look for sheep, you maybe find them, and then once you, like, tell us about these methodologies. How does one find a lost sheep? I mean, it's not a lost sheep, it's just a wild sheep, but how do you find them? What do you do once you find them? Do you kind of stick with the same group all day? Do you kind of get a head count, time, make some notes, and then go off to find the next group? Does it depend?
Yeah, so the basic of going out there and just looking for the sheep and finding them and taking that census of writing down the individuals that were observed together in one group at one time in one place, that is a constant throughout all seasons. That's like the baseline, that's the goal, and that's really kind of the main thing that we're using in a lot of the, essentially, that's all that I used in my thesis. And then dependent on the season, there are some surveys that I would stay with a group for longer and observe some of these like micro behaviors, mm-hmm. and write down like this, you did a bedding displacement of this ewe and she kicked her and kicked her out of her spot. Yeah. And it's really interesting, the ewes have a dominance hierarchy too, along with the males, and everybody knows about the males and the clashes and everything, but ewes are doing that too. It's just a lot less obvious.
Yeah.
And it's happening within these social groups that they're hanging out in all of the time. So sometimes I would do focal follows of specific behaviors. Sometimes I would do a series of photographs. I was trying to map out in a really 2D space of photos, but how close together the sheep are and how far apart they spread out from each other and then come back together, as opposed to splitting into two different groups, to sort of kind of try to get at a baseline understanding of what is a group, what what constitutes a group of bighorn sheep, and at what point do they just drift off and become two groups.
Gotcha.
So dependent on the season, I could be doing some other surveys like that. The main thing in the fall for the breeding season in the rut is to try to establish whether or not any and which ewes are in estrus, mm-hmm. on any given day. So that is pretty much following the behavior of the rams to tell whether or not any of ewes are in estrus. So that's the main one there. In the lamb rearing season, the main thing is observing groups and looking for one ewe to split off from groups, because that means she's gone off somewhere to have her lamb, mm-hmm. and we want to get the birth dates as close as possible. Mm-hmm. So that season can be pretty crazy of trying to find one single sheep as opposed to looking for a group of sheep.
Yeah.
Oh, and getting those birth dates and then sort of tracking the ewes as they establish these nursery groups.
Mm.
As opposed to groups of ewes who have yet to give birth and ewes who have already lost their lambs.
Mm, okay.
So, but essentially everything is strictly observational.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah, that sounds super labor intensive. And it, I mean, I find this study so interesting because it just, I was going to ask, why do you do it that way? But it honestly sounds almost self-evident that this is just not the sort of thing that a camera trap can do. It's not something a GPS collar could do, unless I guess you collared every animal in a group, which I'm sure someone has done with some group of animals at some point, but seems very expensive. Yeah. And kind of invasive as well. And obviously, again, something that our dogs couldn't help with. So what are some of the values of this sort of data? This really, I mean, this sounds like old school ecology. Like, I think when most of us who majored in ecology were choosing our major, this is what we were thinking about wanting to do. So what are some of the advantages to continuing with that instead of just doing like modeling, or, you know, instead of just having a GPS collar on a couple of animals? Like, what are we actually learning from all of this, and how does that matter for the sheep? Does it matter for the sheep?
Yeah. Oftentimes I feel like, especially today, and for a lot of my peers who are getting their master's or PhDs, their data come from GPS collars. Oftentimes when we talk about movement ecology, obviously, especially but and GPS collars can provide incredibly detailed information up to hourly locations, very specifically, of individual movements, and that's incredible information. But we still don't know who else was in that group with that animal, what motivated that animal to make that movement. And we usually make the assumption that an animal has made a movement that most aligns with its best fitness. So the motivation behind a movement is either procuring the best mates, or getting the best food, or avoiding predators. But for example, this is a really obvious example, but like if we had a collar on a lamb and we were making that assumption about this little lamb's movements and him going to a place that has the best grazing opportunities, we're going to be completely wrong, because he's just going where his mother is.
Yeah.
And so he's going where theoretically it increases his mother's fitness as much as possible.
Right.
So that information can be incredibly helpful and accurate oftentimes when we do these habitat selection models and stuff like that. But one of the really interesting things that I found in my thesis was that when I used the social information of who occurred in what group with who, I had essentially just as much predictive power as a really good habitat selection function.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So if we leave out the concept of these social trade-offs in risks and benefits, we're missing an entire space of decisions that these animals are making. And I don't know exactly what consequences that can or will have, but it's an entire realm that we're often just ignoring.
Right. So yeah, you're if I'm getting you correctly, what you're saying is those habitat selection models might have like a 40% predictive value or something for what their animals are doing on a given point. And what you were able to garner from these observations also had, you know, again, like a 40%, you know, whatever that is, predictive value for what the animals were doing and what they were choosing to do. So did you find what did you find helped predict it? Do they have buddies? Like, do sheeps have best friends? Do they hang out with their mom and their siblings? Or is it just age groups? Like, what does push who hangs out with whom in the sheep world?
Yeah, group size was a big one. And that was almost sort of like a null model in my hypotheses, was that, okay, I'm out here talking about the social behavior of these bighorn sheep. What if they're just choosing groups, an ideal group size,
yeah,
that is best for predator avoidance and minimizes forage competition?
Yeah.
But even outside of that group size, like, that's absolutely a factor.
Yeah.
They do have a group size that they prefer, and over the 40 years, as populations have fluctuated, we can show that the average group size, or like chosen group size, median group size, all of those don't scale linearly with population.
Oh, okay.
So they are choosing some ideal group size. Outside of group size, I found that sheep, especially when they're younger, this effect decreases in strength as they get older, but they are choosing groups more often that have their mother in them.
Okay.
And they're also choosing for their siblings, even in the absence of their mother.
Okay.
So thinking that, okay, well, if they're all choosing for their mother, then it's going to look like they're choosing for their siblings. But even in groups without the mother, they are choosing for more numbers of their siblings.
So what is the ideal group size if I'm a bighorn sheep?
At least on the bison range, it's somewhere between like 15 to 20 animals.
Okay.
And that essentially holds true across all population sizes.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. So why don't we talk a little bit about, just because this is interesting to me, and I think it's important to talk about for this particular group of sheep, kind of what's been going on with this crew over the last 40 years, because as you mentioned, this group size isn't necessarily changing just because the population has changed, and there have been some pretty dramatic population changes over the 40 years of this study. So why don't we talk about this, just because we've got you here and we're talking about the sheep, so.
Yeah, absolutely. The bison range herd of bighorn sheep has had some incredible fluctuations in a population going back for as long as we have data. And that ranges from 15 animals up to 230 animals. There is some evidence in the history going back of the herd of pneumonia outbreaks, but a really bad one and a really well-documented one due to Dr. Hogg happened in 2016. So the sheep encountered Mycoplasma ovipneumoniae, which is, if you hear about sheep pneumonia, that's the one. It's the bad one. They contracted that in probably June or July of 2016, and by the time I came on the project in fall of 2018, there were 30 sheep left when there had been 230 before. Yeah. So yeah, really huge all age die off. It wasn't just the young or the old, it was across the board. And the most insidious thing about this disease is that it can lead to longer term lamb mortality, even if most of the adults gotta put the sniffy away. I'm still holding this microphone. Apologies. All right, I'm gonna try again for like the fifth time. The most insidious thing about this pneumonia is that it can lead to longer term lamb mortality. So there are some animals who can become chronic carriers of this disease, and even if all of the animals in the population except for one have cleared the disease and there's one chronic carrier, especially because bighorn sheep can live to be 15 years old plus comfortably, if you have a ewe who's 2 years old and contracts it and becomes a chronic carrier, she can give it to all of the lambs every year for like 10 more years, and the lambs will all die because of this disease. So there were 2 years where we didn't have any
successful reared lambs. They all died. And there was one carrier that we discovered in a test and remove study. But another interesting thing that happened in the history of this population was a genetic rescue. Back in like 1985, shortly after Dr. Hogg started the study, there was some definite bottleneck happening due to inbreeding and low genetic diversity. So they brought in, I want to say 10 ewes, over the course of like 5 years. And that was an incredibly successful genetic rescue. And the population had been sort of, I think, stuck around like less than 50 for sure. And within the next decade, it was up to like, yeah, yeah. So it really skyrocketed after that. So after that genetic rescue, next decade, it was over 100 for sure in population. So it really worked.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, and I think it's just important context for this study that like for over the last 40 years, it hasn't just been watching this stagnant population. Not that there really are. I mean, there are more stable populations. This is a relatively unstable group of sheep or population of sheep.
This podcast is brought to you by our Patreon group. For as little as $3 a month, you get to ask questions for upcoming episodes, and you also get access to our online student alumni Facebook group. At $10 a month, you can join monthly coaching calls and book club calls. At $25 a month, you can submit video of you and your dog for kind, thoughtful discussion and feedback during each of those calls. And finally, at $50 a month, you get private coaching calls with me at each month. We also have exclusive merch for loyal patrons and occasional workshops, webinars, and other secret goodies for the group. We appreciate your support.
So yeah, what else do you want to tell us about your sheep? And then I think I'd kind of like to turn it to you and talk a little bit about maybe your methods, my methods, what questions you have about detection dogs, and just riff a little bit on kind of the differences of what we're up to and what we're able to study with these really different methodologies that still both count as non-invasive. Hooray. So yeah, what else do you need to add here?
Both because the bison range is restricted in physical space. There is an 8-foot fence. Motivated bighorn sheep can jump an 8-foot fence, but they don't often unless they really want to. So more or less the landscape has stayed the same throughout the 40-year study. And that allows us to kind of remove the physical aspect that is often the basis for these habitat selection models, and essentially do the same thing as a habitat selection model based exclusively on the behavior of the animals.
Yeah, so then is there anything else that you wanted to bring up there? Or if you're ready, let's kind of turn the tables and see if there's any questions you have about detection dogs. And, you know, because I think we've talked about a couple different aspects that may be interesting for other questions that you actually can't answer through direct observation. So why don't we go down that rabbit hole if you're ready for it?
Let's do it. Yeah, so there have been a couple of times throughout the course of this study where I have collected scat and people on the study previously have collected scat, and dogs would absolutely help with that. I'm not really sure. I'm interested to hear what you think. So when I collect scat, I want to know exactly who pooped it and when. So I watch the groups and I make a little treasure map when I see them poop, and then I go find that exact poop and I collect it, and that ensures that I know who it was. Mm-hmm. There are, of course, genetic studies that you can do to tell which animal the poop came from.
But the
timing is unclear on that, and it's pretty expensive. Mm. It's probably, I think it's probably less expensive given the time it takes to pay me to be out there collecting the scat. Probably
probably more cost efficient to have me collect the scat than it would be to do the genetic studies. But using a dog for this would get you a lot more samples, depending on what you're trying to look at, which you all already know this.
Yeah. So what are you doing with those scats that, so you know who individually they come from? Are you then looking at like hormone levels or specific things? Yes, hormone levels.
Yeah. And pathogen loads. So like worms.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. And I think, you know, I think, yeah, it might be potentially faster if, you know, you take your treasure map and you're able to use that to determine which individual that scat was from, but then use the dog to help you find them more quickly. That maybe help may not be that necessary for how you've been doing it. Sounds like you've been pretty successful, but I could see that being helpful in some environments. Where, okay, you've had your scope on these animals, you know roughly where they pooped, but it would take you an hour to try to comb through and actually find it. It might be helpful to have a dog kind of search that micro area to find it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are times that I feel really confident about where I think the scat is going to be. And I get up there and there's four piles and I can't tell which one. So then I've spent all that time and I don't collect it if I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. So that is kind of wasted time.
Yeah, and a dog wouldn't necessarily help with that, I suppose. Although you could, I mean, hypothetically, if you wanted, you could train a dog to find a given individual, but that wouldn't necessarily help if you don't want to find the same individual every time for perpetuity. Yeah. So, yeah. And I think, I mean, the other thing that would be a limitation for this is if you wanted to be able to do this in real time, which I assume you would then need to have the dog with you in the field, and you would need to have a dog who would just be willing to hang out until you were ready for that. And it just honestly doesn't sound that practical. I think you and I had talked at some point about, you were interested in toxo, right? In mountain lion latrine sites. And we had talked a little bit about how helpful, I think dogs would be, that's a better example, maybe, of a way that dogs could be useful in this particular study is, okay, like, can we train the dogs to go find these mountain lion latrine sites? And then you can use that to then test for toxo. Why were you interested in toxo again?
In 2020, of course, the bighorn sheep on the Bison Range contracted toxo, at least half of them. And we know this because we had a lamb that was born that had some issues, was potentially completely blind, maybe couldn't even stand. We know it did not nurse at all. It was actually killed by a golden eagle, but we were able to collect the carcass, and that's how we knew that it was toxo. And only half of the ewes that year even gave birth successfully, that as far as we could tell. So that was a real bummer, especially coming on the on the tails of that all-age die-off from MOV. So I was really interested in trying to find evidence that it did come from mountain lion scat, that's where they contracted the toxo, or bobcat scat. There are both animals. And just sort of wondering how prevalent it is on the Bison Range, and perhaps being able to track down like where and when they contracted it. And I guess I don't really know what it would help to be able to tell, but like potentially, since I have daily group information, I could say it was this group that went through this area and got it.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah, and it's the sort of thing where I guess we haven't necessarily thought of the question. We're just, you know, kind of going through some ideas here. Yeah, and the other one that I guess has come to mind as well would be, I know there have been successful studies in the past where they've actually trained dogs to not just detect the scat of a given species, but to detect scat of individuals that are infected with a given disease or pathogen. So that could be potential, like, for example, when you were talking about that, what is it called? The
find and remove?
Yeah, test and remove.
Test and remove, to actually remove the U that had MOU, M-O-V.
M-O-V.
M-O-V, yeah. M-O-U. Memorandum of understanding. Yeah, the U that had the M-O-V that was unwittingly killing all of the lambs.
Yeah.
Yeah, hypothetically, that could be something where I think it might be a lot of work in this given population, in this specific setup, to train a dog just to find that and then go and do that through scat. But it would be possible. And I know it's been done with brucellosis. Working Dogs for Conservation has worked on some of that. I know, I mean, chronic wasting disease, they're generally looking at tissue samples, I believe, but they've done it with a variety of sample of pathogens.
And that would actually have consequences far beyond the bison range, because MOV is pretty prevalent all across the range of bighorn sheep and can, as the bison range shows, be really devastating to a herd. So it, and there are a lot of these test and remove studies that are done in bigger populations where it's a lot harder because we know everyone, and so we know when we've tested everyone. But if you didn't have to do that and you could send out a dog to find the ones who had it, that would be a lot faster, and I would imagine probably more cost effective in the long run if you can save a lot of time. And the tranquilizers are expensive, right, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that was my next question. So how did you do it? I mean, you only had 40-ish animals at this point. So yeah, it would be a lot easier than if you were in a much larger ecosystem where it could be any number of, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of individuals. But yeah, so there were tranquilizers involved. Was that, were there helicopters involved? You know, like how intense was it to actually tranquilize and then test each individual animal? Is that what was done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Since we had like 30 at that time, so it was doable, but definitely took a lot of time because we were just ground darting. So it was me and Jack had an air rifle and tranquilizer darts, yeah, those tranquilizers and the reversal for the tranquilizers. None of that is cheap, and some days we just like didn't really get a good shot. If the sheep were really jumpy and we couldn't get close enough, so you have to physically get close enough and get the animal, and that took a lot of time even for 30 individuals. So we did not use helicopters, which did keep some of the cost down, but there are other sites who are using helicopters and doing test and remove operations sort of in that way. That's probably a lot more expensive. That I bet if you could get a dog to go out there and say and find the individuals that have MOV, that would be incredibly helpful.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the stories that I tell not infrequently when I'm talking about some of the benefits of conservation dogs and really non-invasive sampling in general was during my mammalogy class in undergrad, we went out and shadowed some bighorn sheep researchers near Colorado Springs. And they were telling us, I can't remember exactly what the research was, but they were, we went out and we, you know, they had the collars and they were showing us how to use them and, you know, taking us around and showing us how hard it is to do telemetry in the Rockies. They were talking about, yeah, chasing sheep down. I mean, chasing them down sounds a lot worse than it is intended to be, but functionally that's what it is, in a helicopter to dart them, and just how dangerous that was for everyone involved and how challenging. And I just remember kind of walking away from that being like, wow, I hope those data are worth that, for kind of the stress and risk for everyone involved. And the researchers really cared about these animals. I'm not saying they don't at all, but I just remember kind of walking away from that being like, wow, that's tough. And even on foot, you know, it's just risky. I know, I think it's Robert Sapolsky's book, A Primate's Memoir, talks about he spent a lot of time out darting baboons, I believe in Kenya, trying to look at stress levels of different animals based on dominance interactions, and he needed to be able to take blood from the moment. And it was just, this book, like, I highly recommend to anyone who's listening, because the descriptions of trying to
get close enough to get these baboons, to tranquilize them, and trying to do that undetected so he didn't spike their hormone levels by the fact that they knew they were about to be tranquilized. Yeah. or I mean, and also, like, especially for the lower ranking individuals, that they weren't going to get picked on by a dominant individual as they were going down was really important in that study. And I just remember that whole book that I was reading, or all those passages, just being like, God damn, this guy needed a scat dog. And I, you know, also, you know, some hormone stuff is really hard to do over scat. Sometimes you do just kind of need blood. And I think one of the limitations potentially to this for this, oh my gosh, what was it? Find and track and remove?
Test and remove.
Gosh. One of the limitations I could think of as far as the dogs for this test and remove would be, so say you had an individual, a potential population or meta population of like 500 individuals. If you have the dog and the dog goes out and the dog identifies the scat that is infected, you've got the dog that's just successfully trained to find MOV scat only. You then would need to be able to figure out how to match that to an individual. So you would still need some sort of pretty intensive database to be able to use that, unless you had something like your field observations, where you could say that if the dog hits on this scat and we know that this individual pooped this scat through observation, you would either need the observations or that genetic data, I think. So it's still not, I think it's just, I really like talking about this stuff as far as these areas where the dogs might not actually be the best choice, or might not actually be able to solve a problem, or maybe they are, but they're still not perfect. And I think that's just really important to explore. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think there, in this hypothetical situation, I think there would have to be a lot of time sensitivity to it too. You would have to catch the symptoms of the disease before it spread throughout the entire herd, or spread throughout one of the populations in a meta population, etc. And that could potentially work. Like, if you catch the symptoms early enough and you know that there's a subgroup that your dog has alerted to some scat with MOV, I suppose there are a lot of calculations that would have to go into effect, but if you know that it is only in this group, you could cull that whole group and stop it from spreading to the entire population. But that would require catching the symptoms as soon as they come up.
Yeah, and I mean, if you've got a disease that in your case had, you know, we did a little bit of math here, an 80% fatality rate, mortality rate, yeah, potentially culling a group of six might make the most sense. Again, we're really in hypothetical land right now, but
This is a disease that is across their entire range, so there are instances where this could be plausible, that these specific conditions would actually occur.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, and the other thing that could be helpful for the to use with the dogs, if for whatever reason permitting or stress of the subject animal kind of prohibits bringing the dogs into the field, you could also have a gajillion samples from known individuals, and then just do a lineup in the lab, and just have the dog checking in a lab, which probably would be more efficient anyway. And I think a lot of times for these sorts of studies where you're asking the dog to discriminate so finely, you know, MOV versus non-MOV scats, it's a hard task for a dog. A lot of times those studies tend to happen in labs anyway, where for, you know, somehow they're collecting all of these samples and bringing them into an area and having the dog basically go through 50 and say no, yes, no, you know, rather than having the dog go out and search. That happens as well, but it varies quite a bit. So as we're wrapping up here, is there anything else you wanted to kind of circle back to as far as your methods, your research, any questions you have for me about conservation dogs, anything like that?
Yeah, so just in thinking about ways that dogs could potentially fit into this long-term study, a lot of my time in the field is spent looking for the sheep. And since we don't have any collars, sometimes that's really hard. And we've thought about what would it be like if we collared like two or three of the dominant ewes who tend to sort of be leading their own groups? And then would that allow you to find, you would find at least one group every day. Mm-hmm. But potentially, could, how would you see it happening if we had like a dog that is just looking for bighorn, mm-hmm. and we want them, like, where are they right now? But also, they're a prey animal and would probably be very scared of dogs. Like, what, how could you picture that happening?
Yeah, I think the GPS option would probably make more sense. But if for whatever reason you didn't want to or you can't, or, you know, the dogs would be able to find any group.
Yeah.
Just send them out. Yeah, I mean, as you said, they're a prey animal. There actually was, I was trying to do some research a while ago for a presentation I did on compassionate conservation and non-invasive research, and they're actually one of the only studies I found that talked about the difference, or the reactions that wild animals have to even leashed, well-behaved dogs in the wild was on bighorn, and they did find elevated heart rates and, I believe, cortisol levels, even in a leashed dog moving through or past. They also had elevated heart rate cortisol levels for people. Yeah. and dogs are usually attached to people, so it's not great. But, you know, then imagining having a potentially off-leash detection dog. I mean, you could do it on leash, but off-leash, for these larger areas tends to speed things up a little bit. You're going to stress them out a little bit. And depending on what their flight distance is, you might kind of end up in this really frustrating situation of like, you're constantly getting like a micro glimpse of a sheep butt disappearing over a ridge.
Which happens anyway without the dog.
Right. And I guess then there'd be the practicality of, okay, so now you've used the dog to find the sheep. You'd probably need two people. So then one person could take the dog back to the truck and the other person can then stick with the group, which often we end up with two or more people in the field anyway for anything much bigger than a wind farm search. Yeah, it certainly would be possible. You could potentially train the dogs to track the sheep, so you would take them to the point last seen and then the dog would actually kind of nose to the ground track the sheep, or you could do more of an air scenting of, can the dog actually just kind of have their nose up in the air and catch the scent? Or you could kind of do, this would actually be pretty similar to what like live find search and rescue handlers do, if I'm understanding correctly, where they don't actually really care if the dog is tracking, trailing, or air scenting. They just want the dog to find the missing person, and the dogs are kind of cross-trained on all skills, and then they just tell the dog to go look, and the dog just, you just find the people. You want that dog to cut corners, you want that dog to follow air currents, or tracks whatever is most salient and fastest. So it probably would be something like that. If you had the dog on lean, you had the right well-trained dog. Potentially, this might even be something where you would be thinking about a smaller dog that might be a little bit less stressful to the sheep. Yeah. Something smaller than a fox might freak them out a little bit less.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, the lambs are still so vulnerable. They probably would still be a little unhappy about it. But yeah, it certainly could be helpful. And that would probably be another thing that might be a good fit for... I would love to do an episode on some point kind of on this topic of kind of the utility of like field tech conservation dogs that aren't necessarily these really high caliber professional dogs that have dozens of target scents and do this all the time and they go on different projects and they get hired for this work, but more like, you know, you're a field tech and you would bring your dog into the field with you sometimes anyway, so you train them to find your dropped transmitters, you train them to find the scat just because they kind of picked it up on their own anyway. I know Dr. Simone Gadbois talked about that's actually how his first dog was trained. He was out finding coyote scat all the time, and his dog just kind of started picking up on it because they would stop and investigate it, and the dog kind of started being like, hey, you want this over here, right, dummy? And there are lots and lots of stories of dogs doing that in the field, and this might be something that would be a good fit for that because it's a good kind of cost reducing measure. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be paying for a conservation dog, you probably want to have that dog in the field doing really, really solid work for you every day. Versus, you know, if you just had a dog, I know you don't, but if you did and you had a dog who kind of had enough, I've been speaking so much Spanish lately, I was like, enough ganas, enough espirit, enough drive for this sort of thing and kind of was in the field with you anyway, you know, it would be probably a better fit for that, or in kind of like a a specific, well, you would need to have the dog already trained for this, but if you kind of had a dog on deck that did kind of know how to do it and you could just pull them out when you really need it, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Like if I can't find them, which sometimes they are prey species, and they're very good at hiding. So sometimes I can look, the worst days I can look for 12 hours and not find a single sheep. Especially if they're all in one group and I'm looking for the one place on like 8,000 acres where there are sheep. It can be kind of frustrating. So a situation where, like, maybe in the morning or after a couple of hours, if I can't find them, I just need to know generally where they are. And I want to look from a distance through a scope anyway. And I kind of just need to see them. So I could see there being some utility for a dog in some situations like that.
Yeah, totally. Especially if you just, you know, if you've got a dog where that dog can just, yeah, help you track, help you get close enough. And when you see that start of a change of behavior where that dog is starting to get stoked, yeah, that he's getting close.
Even if it's like, oh, cool, they're over that hill.
Yeah, then
I can take the dog back to the truck.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can rest and I'll go see the sheep.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I had the mic kind of turned away from Tony, but yeah, she was just saying that, you know, yeah, if you get the dog pointed in the right direction, she can get pointed in the right direction, take the dog back to the truck, and then go follow the sheep around. But yeah, I think it's just really interesting because none of these examples that we've talked about today are actually really good fits for dogs. And I think, you know, we're kind of riffing on like, maybe you can make a dog work for this and maybe not. And actually, if anyone has thought of anything as they're listening, they're just screaming at their car about something that we've missed, don't hesitate to write in. But, you know, the TLDR of this whole episode is there is just some questions and some studies where dogs are not a great fit. Tony, do you have anything else? I've asked you this now three times that you want to add. And if not, where can people read more about this project, your research, anything like that?
Yeah, I don't think I have any other big points or questions here. I think it's really interesting, and I'll be kind of thinking more about it. And in similar studies, not necessarily mine, where dogs could work or be helpful. But yeah, as far as the study goes, Dr. Jack Hogg has a wealth of really interesting papers about bighorn sheep behavior out there. And my advisor, Dr. Kezia Manlove, has some recent papers and a couple that are going to be hopefully coming out soon that will be a lot more specific to like my thesis. And Dr. Jack Hogg's nonprofit is the Montana Conservation Science Institute. So if you're interested in that, I don't really know. It's just him. I don't know that he actually has anything out there to find. But it's a really interesting study. And Jack has been publishing papers on this since the 80s, including an early paper in Science from this herd. Really interesting stuff.
Yeah, very cool. And we'll see if we can track down any useful links or anything. If there aren't, Jack seems like the sort of guy who might be running something that doesn't have a website.
Yeah, he's sort of this like rogue ecologist. It's really cool.
I'm so intimidated by him, but also think he's very cool. So yeah, that sounds right. And for everyone at home, again, if you've thought of anything that's interesting or have any follow-up questions, do always comment on the Instagram post, join Patreon, and you can just comment. You can just ask me questions in Patreon. And otherwise, thank you all for listening. I hope you learned a lot and you're feeling inspired to get outside and be a canine conservationist in whatever way suits your passions and skill set. And as you've heard today, that might involve just wandering around with some binoculars without your dog. You can find show notes and transcripts, donate to Canine Conservationists, buy merch, and join Patreon over at canineconservationists.org. Until next time.